Wintrust Business Lunch. Welcome back. Farron Dawgs, the CFP founder and CEO at Harrison Wallace Financial Group. What happened this week, Farron?
Well, hello, John. Thanks again for having me. And yeah, it's been quite a week, hasn't it? It's hard to believe that here we are on Friday, down just a fraction for the week. And, you know, I think a lot of it was, you know, we've been hearing about the unwinding of the yen and Japan raising rates, which was certainly a contributor in this. But yeah, also with the jobs report last Friday kind of kicking this off and recession fears, you know, raising their ugly head again. And I think people just felt, you know, now may be a good time for me to just take some profits. And so I think those three items collectively really just, you know, kind of exacerbated the selling in it. And then throughout the week, we've gotten a little bit more tamer data, a little bit less recessionary, and, you know, things have really leveled off and we've seen some really nice comeback in this. So I don't really believe we had much of an overall panic in the market. It was certainly a strong sell-off, but to put it in perspective, you know, it was 2%, 2.5%, and you look at, you know, the bigger corrections and the bigger crashes, if you will, those are significantly greater percentages. So seeing this is not an unhealthy thing. I heard someone say the other day, I wish I could take credit for it, but, you know, as the market goes up, it goes stair steps. When it comes down, it falls out a window. And, you know, it just, I always tell my clients, we have to remember we're investors, we're not traders. And there's a big difference. And so that just, you know, it really puts an exclamation point on the fact we always have to be sure we're rebalancing, we're not stepping out of our risk environment that we're comfortable in, and just keeping a close eye on things.
Yeah. I heard that 80% of the trades made were made by algorithms, which means It's not people calling up their guy or going on their computer and moving money out of the markets per se. But I guess human beings do set those algorithms, so maybe it is reflective of the sentiment of people who are investing. But I'm interested in that distinction, though, that, you know, I didn't know what was going on in Japan. You know, the jobs report,
sure.
if unemployment went up 2%, 0.2%, that didn't throw me into a panic. You know, lucky me, I got a job. But I mean, 1,400 points at one point on Friday. That was just so unexpected, you know?
Yeah, it is. And it is very driven by these algorithms these days, because especially the larger institutions put in these trigger points, and they're basically marching it up as the market goes up. You know, they're putting in higher floors, right? And the minute they get hit, I mean, when you do have a big move, it just kind of is a domino effect. And to me, it's almost as if, you know, maybe they have to look at their algorithms and give these stocks a little more room to breathe before they go into this kind of free fall environment.
We're talking to Farron Dawgs, and we're talking a little bit about the market swings that we've seen this week. And while maybe I'm not going to get on my computer and buy or sell a stock, Farron, I wonder if I should think about the shading of my portfolio, those little pie charts that some of us use or have used for us. What do you think or know about that?
Sure. Well, I work with that quite a lot and have for the last 30 years. And it's really breaking down the portfolios and the investment strategy. You know, are you a long-term investor? Are you, quote, in the red zone of retirement? Or are you in distribution phase? And each one of those is probably going to have a very different view about how they want their investments allocated. And so, for example, I always recommend that if you know you're going to have a need money in the next 1 to 2 years, we have to make sure that that money is safe, right? We need to make sure that it's in something that's not going to move around with the market. Maybe it's not getting quite the return, but it's still going to be there. And, you know, that it can be boring, but I'll tell you, when we have a year like 2022, people are pretty happy to have that money set off to the side so they don't have to invade those other investments. And then on the longer term side, I think, you know, continuing to dollar cost average into your 401ks is great. Be growth focused, you know, be aware of what your time frame is, of course. But I think what's happened over the last few years is that people have, you know, been doing a lot of indexing, right? I just want to buy an index. I just want to do that. Well, the S&P 500 has over 30% of the S&P 500 is technology now. And so your level of diversification is not nearly what it was 15, 20 years ago if you're buying that specific index because it is a weighted index. So many times I don't necessarily disagree with indexing, but I think there needs to be a blend of index investing and active management. So you have passive versus active. So when I'm talking to clients, we're looking at not only the different size companies we're investing in, large, mid, small, even micros at times, but also how is that managed? Is this passive or is it active? And I think there's an argument to have both in the portfolio. But you have to, I think it's important that when you put this together, you kind of look back and you stress test it and say, okay, what am I going to do if this goes down 10%? What is my first inclination? What about 20%? Because everyone has a really high tolerance for risk when the markets just go up, right? It's like, oh, well, these can go down too. So, you know, how are you going to react when that market comes down? And I think people have gotten very overweighted in technology stocks and indexes because, you know, it was set it and forget it. And I don't argue that those indexes have performed well over a period of time. But if you look at the equally weighted index versus a weighted index, you know, the returns are different. You know, the S&P is up year to date about 11-12%. The RSP, which is the equal weight, that's up about 6%. So what are you willing to give up to have a little bit more diversification? Because when I have potential clients come through my door and I do a portfolio review, nine times out of 10, they are super weighted in large growth technology. And trying to get them to diversify can be challenging at times, but over the long period of time, they're going to be a lot happier that they've made that adjustment.
Is there an area you would diversify into? And do you talk about ETFs much?
I do. I primarily use ETFs only, unless it's an actively managed portfolio. And, you know, we do, you know, rotate out. I rebalance with my clients at least annually. And if we happen to have a banner year in a tech area, in an ETF that's tech focused, we will rotate out into maybe where there's a little more value. You know, for right now, what people may want to do after this kind of wake up call on Friday and Monday, they may want to really sit down and say, maybe I should rotate, take some of my gains that I've had over the last couple of years in these high growthy areas. Maybe I should go into some things that are a little more boring, right? Like utilities and staples, consumer staples. Because if there is a recession, and as you mentioned on the opening dialogue, we're getting it from all sides. Some are super, you know, optimistic and bullish, and some are super bearish. But I think to take advantage of this kind of pause after a big downturn is just being a prudent investor and not being too greedy.
You like financials now, too?
I do like financials, yes. I think especially when we start to see interest rates starting to come down, I think lending will pick up again. And I think financials have been kind of neglected over the last couple of years, to be honest. So they have very strong balance sheets. There's no doubt about that. And
Why do you laugh at that, Farron? What is that? What's the source of that laughter?
What, that they have very strong balance sheets?
Well, yeah.
I mean, they do. I mean, for example, some of the larger banks, have not even really been participating in these high yield savings account rates. Like, you can go to various regional banks or small banks and get upwards of 5% on a high yield savings. You go to the big banks, and they're paying you 0.25. They're not participating in these high yield programs, but yet when they're lending at 6.5, 7, right? So their margins are pretty attractive. And so that's why I kind of chuckle when, of course, their balance sheet should be pretty good.
I got it. By the way, I got in. We got to wrap this up, but what do you think? Sure. 1, 2, or 3 cuts this year?
I think we'll see 2. I do think September will be 50 basis points.
50, just given, okay.
Yeah, yeah, I do. I do. And then I think they'll wait until December after that.
Okay, that's Farron Dogs. Always nice to talk to you, Farron. Very interesting analysis today. Farron is the CFP and founder and CEO of Harrison Wallace Financial Group. HarrisonWallace.com is the website. Thank you, Farron.
Thanks, John. Have a good weekend.
Tom Appel, who knows more about cars than you and me. Tom, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you, John.
Good. Tom is the publisher at Consumer Guide Automotive, also the host of Consumer Guide Car Stuff podcast. You're going to be on with Steve and Johnny tomorrow night, too, right?
That's correct. Yeah, always fun.
So if on Saturday night you've got more questions about cars, maybe electric cars, more of a chance to interact with our listeners. And if you've got a question right now, 312-981-7200, you can call or text. We'll try and weave you in. Where should we start? Electric cars, I mentioned. That's still a topic of interest. What's the overview of the electric car market right now, Tom?
It's interesting because despite what everyone thinks, electric car market share is growing, but it's growing very slowly right now. There had been big hopes that we'd hit 10% EV market share in the U.S. this year. That real number is probably going to come in closer to 8%, which will be improvement over last year, but not a huge improvement. We will see more than 1 million EVs built in the or sold in the U.S., however, and that is a landmark.
Do the big three, does Detroit want the electric car market to boom or stall or go in the opposite direction? What do auto workers and automakers want?
What automakers want is for people to just switch immediately to EVs. They don't have to go through the hassle of building both electric vehicles and gasoline-powered vehicles. In fact, one of the big news stories this week, a story shared by Automotive News, is that plant utilization, automobile factory utilization, is going to slump in the next few years because there will be EV plants and gasoline-powered vehicle plants, and neither will be at capacity, which is bad overall for manufacturing efficiency. So the quicker we can move to EVs, the happier Detroit will be.
What about the auto workers?
Workers are concerned, and rightly so, that their jobs are going to be affected by this, and they will. It takes about a third less manpower to build an EV. What's unfortunate, too, is that the batteries, which are so important to EVs, the process of building them is largely automated. So we are not replacing the jobs that we are losing building EVs.
I don't know how to read the politicians when they talk about automobile manufacturing in this country. It would seem to me like EVs are inevitable. I don't want to force anybody out of a job. I don't want to hurt Detroit or whatever, you know. I wonder what the best bet is, either politically or what's best for the country in terms of policies that maybe even subsidize electric cars. What's your thought about all that?
Yeah, and the federal government does subsidize with the federal tax credit for the purchase of new vehicles. Interestingly, I would think that early on it would make sense for politicians to back EVs because there is infrastructure there and there's infrastructure spending. Developing the charging networks that the federal government is backing, things like that, that's a lot of money. Additionally, we have attracted to the U.S., and this is largely because of revisions to the Inflation Reduction Act by Joe Manchin, we have attracted an awful lot of foreign investment in battery plants in the U.S. So initially, this looks very good. We're seeing capital spending in the U.S. We're seeing some factories going in. It's just long term. We're not going to see the manufacturing jobs.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to talk politics. In fact, I want to talk about individual makes and models. But Donald Trump did say this week, everybody's going to be forced to buy an electric car. Everybody's going to be forced to buy an electric car. On its face, that's hyperbolic, but I wonder what your interpretation of that is.
Yeah, it's about 7% true. One of the interesting things about that is there is no mandate to purchase electric cars. There is one in California, and California is going to have to revisit that. California was thinking about going 100% EV by 2035. That's not going to happen. But what we do have, which resembles a mandate sort of, is that there are EPA corporate average fuel economy requirements that the manufacturers have to meet to sell vehicles in the U.S. or be fined, and they're relatively high. They're talking about reaching a number, and this is unadjusted, of about 50 mpg. That's the fleet average for the manufacturer's sales by 2031. Now, that number is a little high. It has to be adjusted down to allow for CAFE changes over the years, so it's more like 35 miles per gallon. And that'll be a challenge for manufacturers to meet. And the only way to meet that is to sell some number of EVs.
So in other words, if we want to sell Chevy Blazers, then we have to produce enough cars that will get much better mileage than a Blazer to offset the 28 miles or 32 miles that a Blazer's getting. So that'll be hybrids or electric cars, which get unlimited miles per gallon. They don't use gasoline. That's the math that we're imposing on the manufacturers?
Yes, and the Blazer is a great example. An all-wheel drive Blazer, a gasoline-powered Blazer with a 2-liter engine, gets about 24 miles per gallon combined. The Blazer EV, which is now on sale, has an MPGe equivalent of 96 miles per gallon. So that 96 mpg is the number that gets dumped into the equation.
What do you think about that? I guess that's fair, right?
I think that is fair, and that's a great way to measure the efficiency of a car. Yeah, that works very well.
What else is interesting to you on the automotive front? Is there a make or a model that seems to be popping these days?
There's some news right now, and it is interesting, especially because we're talking about EVs. Dodge, the Dodge division of Stellantis, was famous for selling its muscle cars, and it was kind of the only thing they were selling. But the V8 engine has been discontinued over at Stellantis, and returning next year will be the Dodge Daytona EV, an electric version of the Daytona. They just priced that today. It'll start about $64,000, but it's an electric muscle car. And we'll see how the public takes to that.
Talk a little bit about Tesla, then.
Yeah, the Tesla story is so interesting. Tesla has an interesting problem, and it was such a juggernaut. The sales kept improving, their profits kept improving, the stock kept going up, and all of a sudden, Tesla sales started to fall, and they're having a hard time maintaining their market share with so much new product. But one of the problems that Tesla has is that they've been spending money in different places, but not on new EV product. And the product has gotten old, and even though there was something like 6 million Tesla owners on the planet, there's really no reason for them to return to Tesla for another car because the product hasn't changed. So Tesla is currently experiencing a sales decline of fairly significant, it's a serious issue for them, and they don't have any new product, apparently don't have any new product on the horizon.
That's interesting. They should talk to Apple. Every year they sell us a new phone. They convince us we need a new, better, different one. They need to say something's improved, but they don't have that to offer right now, huh?
They don't, and Elon Musk would tell you that they've been making small improvements to each car over the years, but those small improvements don't amount to anything really visible to the consumer.
I think we understand that tariffs on automobile manufacturing or manufacturers around the world only hurts consumers in the United States. That said, what's the sort of penetration from China or Europe in the U.S. market?
Yeah, there's almost no Chinese product being sold in the U.S. right now. There is a version of the Buick Envision, that is built in China by General Motors, and Ford builds its Nautilus, the Lincoln Nautilus over there, and there's a couple of Volvos as well. But there is no Chinese maker selling vehicles in the U.S. under a Chinese brand. What is interesting is that BYD, one of the larger EV makers in China, and the company that was largely owned for a while by Warren Buffett, that company is exploring selling cars in Canada, and we'll see what happens there. But a Canadian beachhead does not really lead eventually to U.S. sales.
But what about the Chinese manufacturing? Are those good cars? Would we want them here in the USA? What would they cost? That sort of thing.
Yeah, there's the BYD Seagull is a car that a lot of people talk about, and it sells for $10,000 in China. And there's a lot of discussion about what that would sell for in the U.S. And by most accounts and by most reviews I've read, it's a pretty decent small car. Its range doesn't really meet U.S. requirements yet, and it hasn't been crash-tested or federalized. And I had one estimate. My friend Sam Fiorani at Auto Forecast Solutions suggested if the BYD Seagull was sold here in the U.S., if they could bring it in, and if there weren't heavy tariffs on it, it would still sell for like $25,000. So significantly more than the numbers we're hearing, but still kind of affordable. And then the final question is, will American consumers accept a Chinese bred vehicle?
Well, we got over that hump when Japan came to the United States. We weren't all driving Toyotas, but we seemed to appreciate the quality and consistency of those labels, didn't we?
We did, yeah. When Honda started building cars here in the U.S. in Marysville, Ohio, in the mid-'80s, that seemed to turn the corner for everyone. The Honda Accord was just a delightful, well-built car. It was fuel-efficient. And once it was U.S.-made, consumers seemed to just gravitate towards it.
Maybe you've got a question for Tom Appel, 312-981-7200. We'll pick up a couple of phone lines, try and weed through a couple of texts. 312-981-7200. More business news now. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. United Airlines is discontinuing the print edition of its Hemispheres magazine. You probably found that magazine in the seat back pocket of a United plane. The airline says it'll stop printing Hemispheres in September and will move the magazine online. It first launched in 1992 and over 32 years has won numerous awards for travel writing. It covers destinations where United flies. United was the last of the big legacy airlines to have an in-flight magazine. United recently announced a new digital media network that it says will feature personalized real-time advertising, content, and experiences. Collector cups are returning to McDonald's. The Collector's Meal campaign will feature cups with illustrations from past partnerships, including Beanie Babies, Coca-Cola, Hello Kitty, Barbie, Shrek, Jurassic Park, Hot Wheels, and others. Cups will be embossed glass in foreign markets and plastic in the U.S. Each cup will come with a sausage McMuffin, a 10-piece McNugget, or a Big Mac. Collector's meals with the cups will be available starting August 13th. I'm Steve Brzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Business of Food. Now, here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and it's a Mr. Fizz Friday. Gardening guru Jim Fizzell is on the phone. How are you today, sir?
No complaints. It's a nice day. Out and did our walking. It's a beautiful day. The sun is out. There's very little wind. It's about 70 degrees. Beautiful for this time of year. It could be 90.
Yeah, that's for sure. We've got a question from a listener for you, Jim, after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Mr. Fizz, Joe from Cicero emailed me to ask you if it's too late to start a garden. Apparently, he's been otherwise occupied until now.
No, it's not too late. You know, it's really a surprise. We are just barely past the middle of summer, which was Monday was the middle of summer. So it's not too late. And starting a new garden is a good thing to do right now. Some gardeners never got things planted. Some gardens didn't grow. If you're so inclined, it is time to start the fall garden because there are a lot of things that will do really well in the cool weather of fall that you would normally expect to grow in the spring while it's still cool. This would be things like beans or carrots, turnips. Leaf lettuce is exceptionally good this time of year because it does not bolt. Even beets and chard and mustard will do very nicely. Now, there's some things that you can seed indoors that you can put out in the garden, and it's not too late to start broccoli or lettuce or spinach or even cauliflower if you start it this week. Seedlings will be ready to go out by the middle of September, and there's still a nice long time for plants to grow. Some of those things, the cold crops like broccoli and cabbage, those will even grow well up into the fall, and they'll take a frost, so you don't have to worry about getting them out until it really freezes up. So it's a great time to do that. Now, I just want to mention a little thing about watering. We need to be very careful about watering, but we take water for granted here because we have this little pond out here east of us that supplies us very nicely. So be careful about it. Don't waste it. Now, have a good time with your fall garden. Enjoy it. Enjoy getting out to do it. Enjoy this cooler weather that we're going to have. And let's hope that Greg Solia is right that we're not going to have a frost or freeze until really late in the season, maybe November.
Wouldn't that be nice? Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, our gardening guru. Thank you, sir. On the food calendar, it's National Rice Pudding Day and it's National Passion Fruit Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Tom Appel is on the line with us. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch for a few minutes. He is the, by the way, Tom, do you mind if we just take a couple calls real quick? Or is there anything else you wanted to make sure you got in before we do?
No, calls are fine.
Tom is the Consumer Guide Automotive Publisher. He also does a podcast he's host of called Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. David, you're on WGN. How can we help you?
I'd like to just know his thoughts on the new Honda Prologue EV.
Yeah, the new Honda Prologue EV is an interesting vehicle. It's actually built in conjunction with General Motors. It's on the GM Ultium architecture. I have not driven it myself yet. I'm hearing very good things about it. I think the only complaint we've heard about the Prologue, which is a very good-looking vehicle, a little bit pricey relative to the competition. It does qualify, however, for the federal tax credit because it is built here in the U.S. basically by General Motors.
And has sufficient parts from the U.S. So what's the discount on that? Was it $8,000?
$7,500, yep.
Yeah, okay. Tony, you're on WGN. How can we help you?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is always been, the electric cars have always been a thorn in my side, the way they try selling these things. But 50% of America can't even afford a regular car, more or less an electric one. But I just want to say that I don't believe that it's going to get very far as, you know, they said, well, it's gone up a little bit since last year, and that solar panels have been the same thing. I see three or four people on my block that have solar panels. That was 2 years ago, and none of them have bought any more since then. The biggest thing I want to say to some people understand is all the dealerships around me, again, I'm a 40-year journeyman mechanic. I know lots of people. And the salesmen are telling me that they have meetings, and they're telling them do not take any electric cars in on trade. They've got a lot full of them, new and used, and they can't sell them. Some places, some dealerships have dropped them as much as $30,000, and it's like it was a fad. But to try and push America to be all electric, you can make the cars a whole lot faster than you can make the system that's going to charge them all.
All right, Tony, hold on, Tony. Tony, I know how you feel about this. Let's let our guests respond. What's your thought about all that?
Yeah, there's a lot going on there, but there's a couple things I wanted to add to that. The thing about EVs is that once you test drive them, you like them. They present very well on test drives. And word of mouth is going to work better for EVs than it will for solar panels. But to your caller's point, there is a problem with used EV values right now. And it is interesting and it is disturbing, and it's partly caused by Tesla. Tesla keeps lowering the price of its new cars, which is pulling people interest away from used cars. So used EVs right now are either depressingly cheap or an incredible value, depending on how you look at it. And if you're looking to get into an EV for a very little amount of money, look at used EVs right now. It's a small commitment, and it's a great way to start.
But all the rage right now are the hybrids, right?
Hybrids are super hot right now, and part of the reason for that is there are just more hybrids available. Toyota's lineup is almost entirely available. Each gasoline product is available as a hybrid as well. For not much more money, the hybrid tax or the hybrid extra money is so much more. It's so much less now. The economics work. If you get a hybrid, you'll get your money back over a certain amount of time in reduced fuel costs.
A47 said, I thought vehicles made for the European market have better gas mileage. When imported to the U.S., the efficiency is reduced. Can you confirm that?
It's not that they're more or less efficient. Vehicles built for the European market are more efficient because Europeans demand better efficiency. I don't know that European products are necessarily more efficient. When they're imported to the U.S., the fuel economy might drop simply because EPA numbers are different than the fuel economy measurements, or how they handle the EPA, I'm sorry, the fuel economy metrics in Europe or in China, for that matter.
Do you know what time you're going to be on with Steve and Johnny Saturday?
Midnight.
Well, I'm glad I got you in the middle part of the day. Tom Appel is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and he's on with Steve and Johnny tomorrow night at 12, so dial in. They'll have more time for your Q&A then. It's nice to talk to you, Tom.
Oh, you too, John. Thank you.